Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Le relais, Jean-Claude Tremblay approuve Richard qui cherche mot de l'œil. La passe est ici, il est seul. Il lance.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
And now we will hear Éléonore Lépinard.
Merci beaucoup. Tout d'abord, merci pour l'invitation. Je suis très heureuse d'être ici. Je suis très honorée. Alors, avec l'honneur vient aussi un peu de stress en général. Et le stress ici, vous le comprendrez, vient du fait que je vais parler à la fois du rapport Stasi et du rapport Taylor-Bouchard. Et je vais parler du rapport Stasi avec Jean Bobéro à un mètre de moi. Et du rapport Taylor-Bouchard avec Charles Taylor à maintenant 3 mètres de moi. Donc, la corde est raide ou le chemin est étroit, je ne sais pas, mais en tout cas... Et je vais parler tout ça en anglais. Donc, bon, vous serez tout ça, cette petite introduction pour demander votre indulgence, bien sûr. So I'll switch to English now, and I'll try to make some summaries in French in the middle and at the end of my presentation. So have you all probably have noticed, gender equality has been a prominent issue in debates on secularism, both in France and in Quebec, and in many other places, in fact, including Britain and other continental European countries. So in many ways, what we did witness and are still witnessing is a form of reformulation of Susan Moller Aukin's famous question, is multiculturalism bad for women, into is religious freedom bad for women. So I would like to talk about how in both contexts this dilemma has been solved or mediated in the context of the commission and their reports. I want to ask what solutions do the Bouchard-Taylor report and the French Stasi report, which recommended, except for Jean Bobéro here, the ban on Muslims, Muslim headscarves in public school. What do these reports have to offer for feminists, feminist theory and practice in France, in Quebec, and in other places? So I'll have two main points. The first one is trying to understand how come two reports advise radically different solution vis-à-vis the question of headscarves, which is, or religious accommodation that seem to call into question the gender equality. So how come we have accommodation on one hand and blanket ban on the other in France, as you know? And then my second point is what it means, what these solutions that the report advice can mean for feminism and feminist politics. So the Stasi Commission on Laïcité in France was very much concerned by the issue of Muslim girls and their emancipation. It is an underlying theme in the report. It was the focus of many of the commission auditions. And the principle of gender equality was very early on, even before the work of the commission started, framed as a legitimate limit that can be opposed to freedom of religion in certain circumstances. And indeed, many feminist organizations mobilized to be sure that their view of gender equality would be the one that would be included in the Stasi report. So in Quebec, the story is a little bit different, but it has some similarities. The Bouchard-Taylor report is not specifically focused on the tension between gender equality and some religious practices, to the dismay, actually, of some feminists. But similarly to the French report, it posits gender equality without defining it at all, and it's the same in the French case. But still, it posits gender equality as one of the reasonable and legitimate limits that can be opposed to accommodation. So despite this same framing in both commissions, this same will to take into consideration the tension between gender equality and religious accommodation, the solution advised by both reports are totally different. So does it mean that France and Quebec don't have the same definition of secularism? How can we explain this divergence? So I don't think, but I'm talking under the control of Jean Bobéro here and Charles Teller in front of me. So, but still I say it, I don't think there is any fundamental divergence in the legal framework and the moral content, let's say, of secularism in France or in Quebec. In both states, if I can say states, the legal framework says, I mean, has the same principles. It's a combination of freedom of conscience that includes freedom of religion and worship, separation of church and state, state neutrality vis-à-vis religion, treating religion equally, and also non-discrimination for individual on the ground of religion. So the four elements are the same in both context. Moreover, until 2004, so until the ban on headscarves, the regulation of the tension between religious accommodation and other rights was quite the same. I mean, in its first opinion on the Muslim headscarves in 1989, that said that we shouldn't exclude Muslim girls from school, the Conseil d'État, which is our guardian of civil liberties, of public liberties, stressed that freedom of religion can be curtailed only in exceptionally serious circumstances, and that the limit imposed on religious freedom should be proportional to the objective that the state is trying to achieve, in that case, public order, a Napoleonic notion. The reasoning the Bouchard-Taylor report develops is very similar when it says that the limit to religious freedom must be minimal and proportional to the objective of protecting other rights. So although France maybe did not have a jurisprudence as sophisticated as the Canadian one for cases dealing with religious freedom, there are or used to be more similarities than differences in the way French and Quebecois institutions dealt with the headscarf issue and other religious accommodation before the French ban. So I'm not saying that it's all the same. There are different histories of secularization, different immigration policies, different nation building practices, of course. But still, there were these similarities. So what happened in France, what happened in Quebec, that can explain two opposite solutions in the case of the headscarves, but also in the maybe current development of the framework of secularism. So we could mobilize many institutional, legal, political factors. One is the availability of the concept of reasonable accommodation, which has only been translated very recently in French law from European directive and applies only to disability, for example, whereas here it could be used by analogy by the Supreme Court in the Kerpen case. Another one is interculturalism and immigration policies, etc., etc. But I want to focus on something else, which is something I think which explains why both commissions ended up having very different political solutions to the same problem. This issue is how to interpret the meaning of religious practices and who has the power and the legitimacy to interpret what a religious practice means and for what purpose. So let me explain a little bit about this. In the case of the wearing of the Islamic veil, the Bouchard-Taylor Commission stated on page 144, the position to ban the headscarf, quote, assumes that we grasp the deep, unquestionable meaning of the wearing of the headscarf. The crucial question here is to ascertain who has the right to decide on the meaning of an individual's expressive acts. Is it the state or the individual himself? It is essential that the state ensure that religious practice neither jeopardizes other people's rights nor the pursuit of legitimate legislative objectives that serve the common good, etc. But it says basically that we cannot assume that someone wears the hijab because she is forced to do so. So on the contrary, when the Stasi Commission dealt with the same issue, the report shows some ambivalence, to say the least, or uneasiness. So it states, as the Bouchard-Taylor report, it says, that for those who wear it, the veil can have various meanings. It can be a personal choice or a constraint, particularly intolerable for young girls. End of quote. But the Stasi report also takes into consideration the position of those who do not wear the veil and for whom apparently unanimously, quote, the meaning of the Islamic veil is a stigma imposed on young girls and women which makes them responsible for men's desire, end of quote. And the report further comments that this vision is, quote, fundamentally contradictory with the principle of equality between men and women, end of quote. It is page 57 in that report. So what we see here is, of course, a shift in the interpretation of a religious practice and the construction, in the French case, of an objective meaning of the veil. And this objective meaning is that the veil is coercion. So to be effective, this interpretation has to be articulated to a conception of the relationship between the state and the citizens. So to open the door for state action, you have to find a way to bind that interpretation of religious practice with something the state ought to do or can do. So the legitimacy of the French state to intervene and impose a blanket ban on Muslim headscarves in public school, so breaking with the previous case-by-case jurisprudence that the Conseil d'État had done. This legitimacy to intervene is firmly based on a conception of individual autonomy, of the role of school in promoting and sustaining this autonomy, and of the role of the state in protecting and emancipating individuals, especially women, from their families and communities. So the Stasi report seems to make its own Condorcet's wish that school shall free individuals from forced and voluntary dependencies. The report insists that school must train critical judgment, esprit critique, famous French esprit critique, ensure autonomy and produce enlightened citizens. So state paternalism is justified in order to create rational and autonomous citizens. So we have a form of what we could call a republican perfectionism. And I'm sure you understand what I mean by that. So, of course, autonomy is defined as self-determination and independence from social relations, except the relation of the citizen to the state, because that is the relation that can transform individuals into citizens and foster individual autonomy. The Bouchard-Teller report provides a totally different perspective that I would call liberal functionalist rather than perfectionist on this issue. So what matters, I think, is not in the report, is not individual autonomy, but the protection of individual rights, so that's the liberal vein, and the integration of individuals directly or indirectly through their communities to the larger political community. And here, that's the functionalist part. So the integration process should lead them, in the end, to adopt, we hope, the core values of Quebec society. Schools are important because they are crucial in the integration process and the transmission of common values, not because they foster autonomy. So when the Bouchard-Teller report, draws attention to Orthodox religiosity and its place in a liberal society, it acknowledges that it might be difficult for many citizens to understand the perpetuation of religious practices, which seem to restrain so much individual autonomy. But contrary to the French report, it suggests that one cannot presume of anybody's lack of autonomy just because she or he expresses a difference to her or his religion, family, community. So the state has no legitimacy to ban religious practices. So we have two different visions of autonomy and of the role of the state in promoting this autonomy. So je vais faire un petit résumé en anglais, en français, espérons. Ce qui est un exercice en fait assez compliqué. Je pense que, pour résumer ce que je viens de dire, je ne crois pas que le fait que la commission Bouchard-Taylor ait opté pour l'accommodement alors que la commission Stasi a opté pour une interdiction, traduisent des visions de la laïcité radicalement différentes. Le cadre légal et même l'interprétation du Conseil d'État dans le cas par cas de l'équilibre ou de la balance qu'il faut faire entre le droit à la liberté de religion et d'autres droits était assez similaire à ce que, par exemple, le rapport Bouchard-Taylor prône, c'est-à-dire qu'on doit restreindre la liberté de religion que dans des circonstances extrêmement graves et spécifiques et de façon proportionnelle avec les objectifs que se fixe l'État quand il limite la liberté de religion. Donc, je pense que le cadre finalement de la laïcité était assez similaire dans les deux cas. Alors, comment expliquer que malgré tout on donne des solutions politiques au même problème, des solutions politiques différentes ? Je pense que ça a beaucoup plus à voir avec la définition de l'autonomie et du rapport entre cette définition de l'autonomie et le rôle de l'État dans la promotion de cette autonomie. C'est-à-dire que ce qu'on trouve dans le rapport Stasi, c'est une vision républicaine perfectionniste de l'autonomie individuelle comme autodétermination, liberté par rapport à la contrainte de relations de dépendance volontaire ou involontaire, évidemment rationalisme, les Lumières, quoi. La seule relation qui peut promouvoir cette autonomie, c'est la relation de l'individu à l'État, en particulier à travers l'école. L'État, finalement, est le seul type de relation. Alors, on pourrait dire, mais non, l'État, c'est le pouvoir, c'est l'horreur, c'est ce qui nous impose. Non, pas du tout. L'État, c'est ce qui nous émancipe. Évidemment, on trouve une vision très différente dans le rapport Bouchard-Taylor, qui est plutôt une vision que j'appellerais donc libérale fonctionnaliste. Libérale parce que le souci principal, ça n'est pas l'autonomie, c'est la protection des droits individuels. Et fonctionnaliste parce que il y a une vision très parsonienne, je trouve, de la sociologie parsonienne fonctionnaliste, du processus d'intégration dans la société et du rôle de différentes institutions dans ce processus d'intégration. Donc ce qu'il faut favoriser, c'est finalement l'intégration sur le marché du travail, l'intégration sociale. En ce sens, on ne peut pas porter de jugement sur la nature des pratiques religieuses et l'État n'a pas de légitimité à les bannir ou à avoir une opinion dessus parce que l'État n'a pas le rôle d'émanciper les individus. Donc je pense que les différences de solutions politiques proposées à cet enjeu, qui est un enjeu de comment est-ce qu'on équilibre l'égalité des sexes et l'accommodement de pratiques religieuses, viennent de ces deux visions différentes. Maintenant, deuxième point. Donc je passe à l'anglais. J'ai vraiment l'impression d'être une caricature de Justin Trudeau qui passe de l'anglais au français tout le temps. Mais bon. So how do these two different visions fit with feminist goals? So do both reports or one of the reports provide satisfying answers for feminist politics? And do they resolve the tension between the, or what has been understood as the tension between gender equality and religious freedom? So despite their efforts, the reports have not settled the case. I'm sorry. I don't think they have. I mean, for feminists, at least. Because for feminists, the debate is definitely still going on. So despite the fact that both reports actually tells where to put the threshold, although they don't, it's not in the same place, obviously, it seemed that the answer has not been satisfying to some feminists, especially those who believe a stronger secularism is the only guarantee that gender equality will be protected. And I'm sure you are aware that some feminist organizations suggested that religious signs should be banned from Quebec public institutions, for example. So one could say that it's a matter of feminism. There are good and bad feminists, feminists that understand multiculturalism and diversity, and feminists who don't. And that's it. Okay, so we could say that, but I think we still wouldn't have our answer. So for me, the fact that the debate is still going on, maybe not on the headscarf, but on other issues, indicates that it is not or not only an issue of balancing one right against the other or mediating attention. So part of the problem is the balancing act, of course, judging, interpreting religious practices and their effects. But at a deeper level, the issue goes beyond reasonable accommodation, goes beyond adjusting to orthodox religious practices or just religious practices. Because it is an issue around the definition of autonomy and the role of the state in protecting and promoting that value. And that question directly challenges feminist theory and practice. So let me explain. So what I think is that feminist position in debates on secularism do not so much express or reflect an opposition between feminism and multiculturalism, but rather a crisis of the traditional definition of the feminist project, and more specifically of the feminist definition of autonomy forged, among other things, during the second wave. French feminists have argued that the headscarf is a menace to gender equality. Certainly, partly because they hold prejudices against Islam, but more importantly, because they agree with the implicit definition of autonomy that the Stasi report outlines. Autonomy for them is independence from constraint. It is a form of rationality. It is self-determination. And because they interpret, as the Stasi report did, the wearing of the veil as a symptom of a lack of autonomy, they oppose the wearing of the veil. That definition of autonomy as self-determination and its association with gender equality is very contested within feminism itself. Especially postcolonial feminists have challenged the assumptions shared by many Western feminists and some liberal and republican theorists that individual autonomy and emancipation necessitate the ability for self-determination, rationality, independence from power relations. So their critique underlined the fact that our agency is always limited by social and cultural norms, and that the assumption that minority women are less liberated than Western women is a product of paternalism and denotes a process of racialization of non-Western women. The postcolonial critique directly challenges the desirability and the viability of the feminist project to emancipate all women in two interrelated ways. First, because it stresses differences among women in their aspiration for autonomy. And second, and more importantly, because it implicitly deconstructs the very existence or possibility of autonomy. This critique is not a privilege of postcolonial feminism. Just to give an example, French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu used an aphorism about social determinism when he argued that our choices are les choix de la nécessité, choices of necessity. So in order, of course, stressing that we are all subjected to social norms and structure that make our autonomy understood as ability for self-determination very, very relative. So if we acknowledge both critics, that the feminist definition of autonomy displays a Western liberal bias, and that this liberal vision of autonomy is incompatible with basic sociological premises like sociology class 101, well, what's left of the feminist project of emancipation of all women? So should we forget about it, or can we find a new political language to define autonomy and gender equality? So let me just to conclude quote the attempt at redefining autonomy of legal theorist Jennifer Nedelsky, who suggests that we take seriously the assumption that individuals are social beings, therefore not free or autonomous in the liberal sense, but without giving up the idea and ideal of autonomy. So what we need to do for Nedelsky is to reformulate this notion. Autonomy, she suggests, is not independence from social pressure, social forces, or the power of others, but can only arise within the framework of relationships of power. So in a word, it is made possible by constructive relationships, including intimate, cultural, institutional, national, global, and ecological forms of relationship. So what we need to do is to reflect upon the type of relationships, state institution dependencies that can foster our ability to live following the rule we have chosen for ourselves. And that maybe would be a way to actually ease or solve the dilemma between our conception of gender equality and multiculturalism. And I think that the way the Fédération des Femmes du Québec is currently trying to promote an inclusive women's movement gives us an example of what that approach could lead to. So the FFQ, in one of its recent opinion, has chosen a contextualized approach which looks at the social context of migrant and religious women, at the concrete effect that a ban of religious sign in the public service would have, at multiple intersection of power relations. And this approach will certainly much more enhance women's autonomy than the French paternalist blanket ban on headscarves that supposedly protect vulnerable girls, but in fact leaves them without any social institution to support their choices and to develop their ability to live according their own law, which is the basic definition of autonomy. Je vais résumer en français. Donc, j'ai vraiment l'impression de m'auto-traduire, c'est très bizarre. Donc, à partir de ces deux conceptions différentes de l'autonomie, j'essaye d'interroger finalement ce que les deux rapports peuvent nous dire à propos du projet féministe contemporain et des problèmes que la question de la liberté de religion dans ces différents débats pose pour les féministes. Alors, je remarquais que c'est certain que la position finalement... Enfin, la raison pour laquelle les féministes ont pu vouloir, en France, bannir le voile est probablement, entre autres, parce qu'elles ont des biais racistes et islamophobes, certainement, mais aussi, surtout, parce qu'elles partagent avec la commission Stasi, par exemple, la vision de l'autonomie comme autodétermination, liberté par rapport à la contrainte de certaines relations sociales, en particulier les relations familiales ou les relations dans une communauté donnée. Or, cette vision de l'autonomie, qui est une vision, donc cette vision républicaine perfectionniste, mais qui a aussi son histoire dans la pensée libérale et des Lumières, cette vision de l'autonomie a été critiquée, en particulier par les féministes postcoloniales qui ont toujours souligné le fait qu'il s'agissait d'une vision occidentale biaisée qui, du coup, voit toujours les femmes de l'Orient, les autres, les femmes du tiers-monde, etc., comme dominées parce qu'elles ne correspondent pas, parce que la manière dont elles se comportent ne correspond pas à la définition occidentale de l'autonomie. Et il y a beaucoup de travaux qui vont dans ce sens, par exemple les travaux de l'anthropologue Lila Abouloughod sur les femmes bédouines qui montrent que la manière dont, oui, elles sont dans des mariages polygames, oui, il y a des mariages arrangés, etc., mais si on leur laisse la parole pour raconter leur propre histoire sur ce qu'elles pensent de ces pratiques, on verra qu'elles ont une forme de agency, puisque c'est le concept souvent utilisé dans ces travaux, donc une capacité d'agir sur leur propre vie. Cette critique, néanmoins la critique du féminisme postcolonial, finalement, n'importe quel étudiant de sociologie de première année pourrait la faire, dans le sens où on n'a pas besoin d'aller en Égypte pour constater que nous sommes contraints dans nos choix. Qu'on soit dans une société libérale ou pas, l'autonomie comme autodétermination est une illusion. Enfin, en tout cas, quelque chose qu'on n'expérimente pas réellement dans sa vie. Et donc, si on... Et là, je me suis perdue dans ma propre traduction. Mais si on prend en compte... Voilà, donc si on prend en compte cette critique en disant « bon, bah, très bien, à ce moment-là, on doit laisser tomber le projet finalement d'autonomie, qu'est-ce qui reste du projet féministe ?» Puisque une grande partie du projet féministe de la seconde vague, le projet d'émancipation, est autour de cette notion d'autonomie. Et en m'inspirant des travaux de Jennifer Nedelsky, qui est une juriste, je pense qu'il faut reconceptualiser la notion d'autonomie, non pas comme indépendance vis-à-vis de relations de pouvoir, vis-à-vis de relations de domination, mais dans le cadre de relations. C'est-à-dire, c'est une autonomie dans l'interdépendance. Il faut admettre le fait que nous vivons de manière interdépendante, mais essayer d'aller chercher quelles sont les relations qui nous rendent autonomes, c'est-à-dire capables de nous donner à nous-mêmes nos propres règles. Et en ce sens-là, je prenais l'exemple de la démarche de la Fédération des femmes françaises du Québec, qui, dans l'aspect très contextuel, essayant de se demander quels vont être les effets d'une interdiction du port de signes religieux dans les institutions publiques québécoises sur les femmes migrantes, en allant regarder concrètement, finalement, quelles sont les institutions sociales qui déterminent la vie de ces femmes-là et comment une politique va avoir une influence là-dessus, que cette approche-là est certainement beaucoup plus garante de l'autonomie de ces femmes qu'une interdiction qui, sous couvert de protéger les jeunes filles musulmanes en France, les retire de l'école et les laisse isolées de toute institution sociale qui serait capable, au contraire, de nourrir leur projet d'autonomie individuelle. Voilà. Merci.